A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel's been thinking about the long shadow of September 11th. Not just the attacks themselves, but everything that came after. He says it felt like the West lost its sense of innocence that day, and aviation went from something people genuinely enjoyed to a chore defined by security. But his real question is bigger. How did that single morning reshape the security state, or arguably create it, across the whole of modern life? Not just at airports.
The airport part is where everyone feels it, but it's almost the least interesting piece of what actually changed. The TSA didn't exist before November 2001. It was stood up in under 3 months.
That's a speed run for a federal agency.
1967 was the Department of Transportation. TSA was created and operational in something like 10 weeks. By early 2002, they'd federalized screening at 429 commercial airports. Before that, security was contracted out to private companies hired by the airlines themselves. The screeners were minimum wage, turnover was enormous, and nobody took it seriously because the whole model assumed hijackings ended in Cuba, not in a building.
The model was negotiate, land, refuel, release the passengers. That was the playbook.
Right? And the 19 hijackers understood that playbook perfectly. They exploited the gap between what the system was designed for and what they intended to do. Box cutters were allowed through security because the rule was about weapons that could threaten the crew in a traditional hijacking scenario. Blades under 4 inches were fine.
So the entire post-attack security architecture is a response to a specific exploit in a system that was never designed to stop suicide attackers. Which is why you get the liquid ban in 2006. That plot was broken up in Britain, but the response was to ban all liquids over 3.4 ounces worldwide, essentially forever.
And that's the pattern that repeats. The shoe bomber in 2001, shoes off at the checkpoint, still happening a quarter century later. The underwear bomber in 2009, full-body scanners rolled out to hundreds of airports. Each time the response is to close the last vulnerability, not to ask whether the underlying threat model has changed. It's reactive layering.
The security state in miniature. You don't remove old measures when the threat evolves. You just stack new ones on top.
But let's pull back from airports, because Daniel's right that this is the visible edge of something much larger. Within 45 days of the attacks, Congress passed the Patriot Act, 342 pages. It had been drafted in some form before 9/11, sitting on shelves, and then the political window opened and it went through with almost no debate. The Senate vote was 98-1.
Russ Feingold.
The loan? No. And the provisions people argued about for years afterward. Roving wiretaps, sneak and peek warrants, Section 215, which let the FBI seize business records, including library records and bookstore purchases, all of that was in there from the start. The library provision got the most attention because it was so concrete. The government can demand to see what you checked out, and the librarian is under a gag order and can't tell anyone.
That's the piece that made it tangible for people who weren't terrorism suspects. It wasn't abstract surveillance anymore. It was your local library.
And then the institutional changes. The biggest one nobody saw coming was the reorganization of the entire intelligence community. Before 9/11, you had the CIA, the FBI, the NSA, and about a dozen other agencies that famously didn't talk to each other. The FBI had a memo from the Phoenix Field Office in July 2001 warning about Middle Eastern men taking flight training. The CIA had tracked two of the hijackers into the country and didn't tell the FBI. The walls between foreign and domestic intelligence were deliberate. They were put there after the Church Committee abuses in the 70s.
So the walls were a feature, not a bug.
And after 9/11, the conclusion was that those walls killed people, so they came down. The Office of the Director of National Intelligence was created in 2004 to coordinate everything. The Department of Homeland Security was stood up in 2002, 22 agencies pulled together under one roof, the largest government reorganization since the Defense Department was created in 1947.
22 agencies. That's FEMA, the Coast Guard, Secret Service, Immigration, Customs. It's an enormous portfolio.
And the budget tells the story. DHS discretionary budget went from about $19 billion in 2001 to over $60 billion by the late 2000s. The intelligence budget, the part we know about, went from roughly $26 billion in 1997 to over $80 billion a decade later. And those are the disclosed numbers. The black budget is separate.
So we spent, what, $1 trillion on intelligence over two decades?
Easily. And that's before you get to the wars. Afghanistan started in October 2001, 26 days after the attacks. Iraq in March 2003. The Watson Institute at Brown put the total cost of the post-9/11 wars at roughly $8 trillion by the early 2020s, and that includes future veteran care obligations stretching decades out. 4.5 million people displaced, over 7,000 American service members dead, and the estimates for civilians in Iraq and Afghanistan are, the numbers are enormous and contested, but they're in the hundreds of thousands at minimum.
And the authorization for all of it rests on a single piece of legislation passed 3 days after the attacks, the AUMF.
The Authorization for Use of Military Force, September 14, 2001. It's 60 words long. It authorizes the president to use force against those who planned, authorized, committed, or aided the attacks. That 60-word resolution has been used to justify military operations in at least 19 countries. Yemen, Somalia, Libya, Syria, the Philippines, Niger, none of which had anything to do with 9/11.
19 countries on a 60-word resolution. That's not a legal framework. That's a blank check.
And Congress never replaced it or rescinded it. There were attempts. There was a repeal effort that got some traction around 2017 or so, but it never passed. The executive branch just kept using it because it was convenient. Every president after Bush, Obama, Trump, Biden used the same AUMF for operations that stretched far beyond anything the original language contemplated.
The thing I keep coming back to is how much of this was latent. The Patriot Act provisions existed in draft form. The argument for breaking down the intelligence walls had been made for years by people who thought the Church Committee reforms went too far. The neoconservative case for regime change in Iraq had been articulated throughout the 90s. 9/11 didn't invent any of this. It supplied the political permission.
That's the most uncomfortable reading, and I think it's the right one. The Project for the New American Century wrote a letter to Clinton in 1998 calling for regime change in Iraq. Rumsfeld, Wolfowitz, Pearl, Bolton, they all signed it. When the towers fell, they had a fully developed doctrine ready to go. The shock and awe campaign wasn't improvised.
So the question Daniel's really asking, was 9/11 a turning point, or was it an accelerant? Did it create the security state, or did it just pour gasoline on a fire that was already laid?
I think it's both, and the distinction matters. The institutional architecture, the DNI, DHS, the Patriot Act, that was new. You can point to the creation dates. But the intellectual architecture, the surveillance capabilities, the arguments about executive power, those were all sitting there waiting for their moment. The NSA had been building signals intelligence capacity for decades. What changed after 9/11 was the legal and political constraints came off.
The warrantless wiretapping program, for instance.
Stellar Wind. The NSA began intercepting communications where one end was in the United States without warrants, in direct violation of FISA. This didn't become public until the New York Times broke the story in 2005, and the paper had actually held the story for a year at the administration's request. When it came out, the legal justification was essentially that the AUMF overrode FISA, that Congress had implicitly authorized warrantless surveillance when it authorized military force.
That's an extraordinary claim. A 60-word resolution about military force somehow authorizes domestic surveillance.
And it was eventually struck down by courts, and Congress amended FISA in 2008 to bring some of it under a statutory framework. But the important thing is that it ran for years in secret, and when it was exposed, the political response wasn't to shut it down, it was to legalize a version of it.
The ratchet effect. The emergency measure becomes the new baseline, and the next emergency pushes it further.
Snowden's disclosures in 2013 showed how far the ratchet had gone. The Section 215 collection of phone metadata, every call, the numbers, the duration, the time, was being collected in bulk from American phone companies. The legal argument was that this wasn't a search under the Fourth Amendment because of a 1979 Supreme Court case about a single robbery suspect's pen register. They took a precedent about one criminal and applied it to the entire country.
The Smith v. Maryland case. The logic was that you have no reasonable expectation of privacy in the phone numbers you dial because you voluntarily turn them over to the phone company.
Right. And the government's position post 9/11 was that this applied to every phone call made in America, collected in bulk, stored for years. The FISA court was approving these programs in secret, and the opinions weren't public. When they finally came out, you had judges writing opinions that read like they were struggling with the implications but had no adversarial process to test the government's claims.
Nobody in the room to argue the other side.
The FISA court hears only from the government. There's no defense counsel, no amicus briefs in the early years. It's an ex parte process by design because it's about approving warrants. But when you're approving entire surveillance programs rather than individual warrants, the lack of adversarial testing becomes a structural flaw.
Let me pull this back to Daniel's point about the texture of daily life. Because the institutional changes are one thing, but the cultural shift is harder to measure and maybe more significant. Before 9/11, you could walk someone to the gate at the airport. You could show up 20 minutes before a domestic flight. The whole experience was porous.
I remember arriving at the airport and going straight to the gate. No ID check, no screening for people who weren't flying. Families would meet people right as they stepped off the jet bridge. That's gone, and it's never coming back.
And it's not just airports. Federal buildings put up barriers and armed guards. Public events got security perimeters. The National Mall in DC had vehicle barriers installed. The Capitol got a visitor center built underground so tourists wouldn't enter through the building itself. The physical architecture of public space changed.
Surveillance cameras went from being something you saw in British cities to being ubiquitous in American ones. License plate readers on police cars and highways. Fusion centers in every state. These are intelligence sharing hubs that were supposed to connect federal and local law enforcement on terrorism, but they ended up being used for all kinds of domestic surveillance. By 2012, there were 77 of them.
And the legal framework for all of this got, I want to say, mission creep. But that implies it crept. It sprinted.
The most explicit example is the USA Freedom Act and the various FISA reauthorizations. Each time Congress had a chance to roll things back, they mostly didn't. Section 702, which authorizes surveillance of foreigners abroad but inevitably sweeps in Americans' communications, got reauthorized. The debate would flare up, a few modest reforms would get added, and the core program would continue.
There's an argument that the security state didn't just expand in response to terrorism. It found terrorism to be an incredibly useful organizing principle for expanding into areas that had nothing to do with terrorism. The drug war got folded into homeland security. Immigration enforcement got rebranded as counterterrorism. Local police departments got military equipment through programs that were justified by the war on terror.
The 1033 program. Excess military equipment transferred to local police. MRAP's mine-resistant vehicles showing up in small towns, and the training changed too. SWAT team deployments went from a few hundred a year in the early 80s to tens of thousands annually by the 2000s. The posture of policing shifted from public service to something that looks more like occupation in some communities.
And all of it justified by the same post 9/11 logic. We can't afford to take chances. The precautionary principle applied to security.
Which is a bottomless well. You can always imagine a threat. The precautionary principle in environmental regulation has a stopping point because you're weighing costs and benefits. In security, the benefit is preventing another 9/11, and no cost seems too high when you frame it that way.
The thing that's striking in retrospect is how little terrorism there actually was in the United States after 9/11. There were plots, but most of them were FBI sting operations, where an informant essentially talked a vulnerable person into a plot and then arrested them. The actual successful attacks by foreign terrorist organizations on American soil after 2001. I can count them on one hand.
San Bernardino, the Pulse nightclub, the Boston Marathon, though that was homegrown. The number is tiny, and yet the security apparatus built to prevent them is permanent and still growing.
So the apparatus outlasted the threat by orders of magnitude, which suggests the threat wasn't the only thing driving the expansion.
I think there's a bureaucratic logic that takes over, Agencies that exist to find threats will find threats. The terrorism tip line produces calls. The fusion centers produce reports. The intelligence community produces threat assessments. None of it's fabricated. There are real dangers. But the system is designed to detect and elevate them, and it'll always produce output. The question is whether the output justifies the input.
And the input is enormous. We're talking about a surveillance infrastructure that covers electronic communications, financial transactions, travel records, biometric data. The no-fly list started with 16 names before 9/11. By the 2010s, it had tens of thousands, and the process for getting off it was essentially non-existent.
The no-fly list is a due process black hole. You're not told you're on it. You're not told why. There was no meaningful way to challenge it for years, and when a process was eventually created, it was still opaque. People who had never been charged with a crime, much less convicted, were prevented from flying for years.
And that's the model. The watch lists, the fusion centers, the bulk collection, all of it operates in a space where the normal checks on government power are attenuated because the subject matter is classified. You can't challenge a surveillance program you don't know exists.
The Snowden disclosures changed the public conversation, but they didn't change the underlying programs as much as people think. The bulk phone metadata program was modified. The government no longer holds the data, the phone companies do, and the NSA has to query it with specific selectors. But the capability is still there. Section 702 is still there. The FISA court still operates in secret.
Let's talk about the foreign policy dimension, because Daniel mentioned this reshaping the course of modern history, the Iraq War in particular. It's hard to overstate how much that decision altered the trajectory of the Middle East and American credibility.
The intelligence was wrong. The claims about weapons of mass destruction, the aluminum tubes, the Niger uranium story, all of it collapsed under scrutiny, but only after the invasion. Colin Powell's UN speech in February 2003 was the moment the case was made most publicly, and he later called it a blot on his record. The war killed hundreds of thousands of people, displaced millions, and created the conditions for ISIS to emerge from the chaos of post-invasion Iraq.
And the connection to 9/11 was always tenuous. Saddam Hussein was a secular dictator who had no operational relationship with Al-Qaeda. The administration made the case by association. Terrorism, bad actors, weapons. But the actual link wasn't there.
The Senate Intelligence Committee report in 2006 confirmed that. No collaborative relationship. And yet, by 2004, a majority of Americans believed Saddam was personally involved in 9/11. The linking worked politically, even if it failed evidentially.
The cost in American credibility is hard to measure, but real. The United States invaded a country that hadn't attacked it, based on intelligence that turned out to be wrong, and then botched the occupation so badly that the country became a failed state and a breeding ground for the next generation of terrorists. That's not a judgment. It's a sequence of events.
And then the withdrawal from Afghanistan in 2021, which was negotiated under Trump and executed under Biden. The images of people falling from planes at Kabul airport, the Taliban walking into the presidential palace. 20 years, $2 trillion, and the outcome was the Taliban back in power in a matter of weeks. The whole enterprise collapsed the moment American air power was removed, which tells you something about what we were actually propping up.
There's an argument, and I think this gets to Daniel's deeper point, that 9/11 didn't just create a security state. It broke something in the American psyche. The country went from the unipolar moment of the 90s, the end of history, the peace dividend, to a permanent war footing in a single morning. And 25 years later, we're still on it.
The phrase homeland itself is telling. Before 9/11, Americans didn't talk about the homeland. That was a German word, a Russian word. It had overtones of blood and soil that were foreign to the American political vocabulary. After 9/11, we got a Department of Homeland Security. The language shifted to match the posture.
And the posture is permanent vigilance. The color-coded threat levels, that's gone now, replaced by the NTAA's bulletin system, but the underlying message is the same. Be aware. Report suspicious activity, except that security is everywhere. It's a low-grade background hum of anxiety that wasn't there before.
The generation born after 9/11 has never known an America that wasn't at war. The oldest members of that generation are now in their mid-20s. They've never lived in a country where you could walk to the gate at the airport, where the government wasn't collecting phone records, where the word homeland wasn't part of the political lexicon.
That's the loss of innocence Daniel's talking about. It's not just that something terrible happened. Terrible things happen. It's that the response to it became the permanent condition of American life. The emergency became the ordinary.
And here's the thing I wrestle with. I'm not sure what the alternative was. After 3,000 people were killed in a morning, the government had to respond. The public demanded it. Some of the changes, hardened cockpit doors, better intelligence sharing, those were necessary and probably prevented further attacks. The question is whether the response had to be as expansive and as permanent as it became.
That's the ratchet again. The initial response was understandable. The failure was in never revisiting it, never asking which pieces were still necessary, never letting the sunset provisions actually sunset. The Patriot Act had sunsets built in, and Congress kept renewing them.
Section 215 was supposed to sunset in 2005. It's still there. The lone wolf provision, the roving wiretaps, all of it kept getting reauthorized. The only provision that actually lapsed was the bulk phone metadata collection, and even that was replaced with a different mechanism rather than ended.
So the lesson of the last 25 years is that emergency powers, once granted, are almost impossible to take back. The security state is a one-way door.
And the cultural shift reinforces the institutional one. Americans now accept levels of surveillance and security theater that would have been unthinkable in 1999. It's not just that the government does these things, it's that most people don't find them remarkable anymore. The TSA checkpoint is just part of flying. The cameras are just part of being in public. The warrantless surveillance is abstract enough that it doesn't feel intrusive.
Until it does. Until you're on a watch list and you can't fly. Until your mosque gets infiltrated by an informant. Until your email provider turns over your data without a warrant. Then it's very concrete.
But that's a small number of people relative to the population. The political genius of mass surveillance is that most people never feel it. The burden falls on a small subset, and the majority shrugs because it's not happening to them.
Which is exactly how the FISA system works. Millions of people's communications get swept up, but only a tiny fraction ever know about it. The rest of us just go about our lives assuming we're not interesting enough to be watched.
For most of us, that assumption is probably correct, but that's not how civil liberties are supposed to work. The Fourth Amendment isn't about whether you personally are being watched, it's about whether the government has the power to watch anyone without meaningful checks.
Let me ask you something. If you had to name the single most consequential change that came out of 9/11, the one that most reshaped the relationship between the citizen and the state, what would it be?
The normalization of secret law. The idea that the government can interpret statutes and classified memos, that the FISA court can issue rulings that nobody sees, that the Office of Legal Counsel can write opinions authorizing things like enhanced interrogation that only come out years later if they come out at all. The public doesn't know what the law is because the law is classified. That's a fundamental break with the whole tradition of Anglo-American jurisprudence.
Secret law is an oxymoron. The whole point of law is that it's public, that you can know what's prohibited and what's permitted. Once the rules are secret, you're not living under law anymore. You're living under the discretion of whoever holds the clearances.
The torture memos are the clearest example. John Yoo and Jay Bybee at the Office of Legal Counsel wrote memos defining torture so narrowly that waterboarding, sleep deprivation, stress positions, and other techniques didn't qualify. These memos were classified. The people doing the interrogations relied on them as legal cover. When they eventually came out, they were repudiated and withdrawn, but nobody was held accountable for writing what amounted to a legal justification for war crimes.
The argument at the time was that this was necessary to prevent another attack. The ticking time bomb scenario. We had to get information from Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and others, and normal interrogation wouldn't work.
The Senate Intelligence Committee report on the CIA's detention and interrogation program, the 6,000-page one, of which only the executive summary was released in 2014, found that the enhanced interrogation techniques didn't produce unique intelligence that prevented attacks. The information was either obtained before the techniques were used, or it was false, or it could have been obtained through other means. The whole premise was wrong.
We crossed a line that we said we'd never cross, and it didn't even work.
The people who authorized it faced no consequences. That's the other legacy. The security state operates with near total impunity. The architects of the Iraq War didn't go to prison. The authors of the torture memos became law professors. The officials who authorized warrantless wiretapping weren't prosecuted. The message to future officials is clear. In a crisis, do whatever you think is necessary, and the system will protect you.
That's a grim note to land on.
It is. But I think it's the honest answer to Daniel's question. 9/11 didn't just create new institutions, it changed the incentive structure for government officials. The lesson of the last 25 years is that overreach in the name of security carries no personal cost. The lesson of Iraq is that catastrophic intelligence failure carries no personal cost. The lesson of the torture program is that authorizing war crimes carries no personal cost. So what exactly is supposed to deter the next overreach?
Nothing in the system as it currently exists. The only check is political, and the politics of security are asymmetrical. The politician who votes against a surveillance program gets blamed if there's an attack, while the politician who votes for it pays no price when the program abuses civil liberties. The incentives all point in one direction.
You've both missed the thing that actually changed the most.
Go on.
It's not the agencies and it's not the laws. It's the database. Before 9/11, the FBI and the CIA and the INS and the State Department all had their own systems, and they didn't talk to each other. After 9/11, the answer to that was to build a system that talked to everyone. And once you build that system, you don't just use it for terrorism, you use it for everything.
The consolidation of databases.
I worked a contract job in 2005, data migration for a fusion center in the Midwest. The stuff they were pulling in, DMV photos, property tax records, utility bills, school enrollment, none of it had anything to do with terrorism. But the grant money was for counterterrorism, so you call it counterterrorism and you pull in everything you can get your hands on. The guy running it told me the real value wasn't catching terrorists. It was that, for the first time, a local cop could run a name and see the whole picture. Every interaction with any government agency, in one place.
That's the thing that never gets rolled back, because it's useful for ordinary law enforcement.
Nobody's going to unplug the database. The terrorism justification got it built, but the drug cases and the fugitive warrants and the child support enforcement keep it running. The security state didn't just expand. It merged with regular government. You can't separate them anymore. The same system that's supposed to catch the next hijacker is the system that checks your immigration status when you get pulled over for a broken taillight.
That's a better answer than mine. The secret law is the constitutional problem, but the database is the practical one. It's what people actually encounter.
It keeps growing because nobody's job is to make it smaller. Every agency wants more data, and once they have it, they find uses for it. The FBI's next generation identification system has something like 50 million facial recognition images now. Most of those people have never been charged with a crime. Their photo was in there because they applied for a job that required a background check, or they got a passport, or they were in a DMV database that got shared.
The accuracy problems with facial recognition are well documented. False positives, racial bias, the whole thing.
Doesn't matter. The system's built. Nobody's taken it apart. I spent 6 months moving records into a SQL server that probably still has my cousin's high school yearbook photo in it, and he's never been within 100 miles of a terrorist.
Your cousin's yearbook photo.
The school district digitized everything, and the Fusion Center got a copy. I don't know why. I just wrote the queries.
That's the thing about the database. Once the data exists in digital form, the marginal cost of adding it to the system is essentially zero. There's no gatekeeper saying no because nobody's even asking.
The gatekeeper is a script that runs at 3 a.m, and it doesn't have opinions.
The security state's real legacy isn't the TSA checkpoint or the Patriot Act. It's that the government now has a unified, searchable record of your life, built for counterterrorism, and used for everything else.
You paid for it. The grants came from DHS. Your tax dollars at work.
I keep coming back to something you said earlier, Korn, about the ratchet only going one way. The database is the physical manifestation of that. You can let a Patriot Act provision sunset, but you can't uncollect the data. Once it's in the system forever.
The backup tapes alone. You'd have to burn 1,000 buildings.
I want to push back on one thing, though. You said the database is the thing that changed the most. I think the thing that changed the most is the expectation of privacy itself. A 20-year-old today has never lived in a world where the government didn't have this capability. they don't experience it as a loss because they never had it. The baseline moved.
That's probably right. My nephew sends his location to a dozen apps and doesn't think about it. The government having it doesn't bother him because everyone has it.
The commercial surveillance and the government surveillance merge too. The government doesn't need to build its own tracking system when it can buy location data from brokers who got it from your phone. The post-9/11 architecture was about government collection. The current architecture is about government purchasing. Different mechanism, same result.
The legal framework for that's even weaker. The Fourth Amendment restricts what the government can collect directly, but the third-party doctrine says you have no expectation of privacy in information you've shared with someone else. So, if a data broker has your location history, the government can buy it without a warrant. The Supreme Court said in Carpenter that cell site location requires a warrant, but that was about the government compelling the phone company to turn it over. Buying it from a broker is a different legal question that hasn't been fully resolved.
The broker doesn't care who's buying. They've got a price list.
The post-9/11 security state didn't just expand government surveillance. It created the conditions for a whole private surveillance industry that the government can then tap into without going through the legal process it'd need for its own collection. The ratchet has a second gear.
That's the thing I'd want Daniel to sit with. The question was how 9/11 reshaped the security state. The answer is that it created the initial architecture, the legal authorities, the institutions, the databases, and then that architecture became self-sustaining. It no longer depends on terrorism to justify itself. It's just how the government works now.
The loss of innocence isn't about being scared of another attack. It's about knowing that the government built a surveillance infrastructure for a specific reason, and then quietly repurposed it for everything else. And there's no political mechanism to put it back in the box.
We haven't even talked about the financial surveillance. The Treasury Department's ability to track international transfers, the SWIFT program, the way the banking system became an arm of the security state after 9/11. That's a whole other layer.
The Bank Secrecy Act was already on the books, but the Patriot Act expanded it dramatically. Suspicious activity reports went from a niche compliance requirement to a flood. Banks now have entire departments dedicated to filing SARs, and they file millions of them a year. Most of them are noise, but they all go into the system.
FinCEN-S, the Financial Crimes Enforcement Network, became a major intelligence agency in its own right. The line between anti-money laundering and counterterrorism and sanctions enforcement blurred completely. If you've ever had a bank account frozen or a transaction flagged, you've touched the post-9/11 security state.
The whole thing is so sprawling at this point that it's hard to even describe its boundaries. It's not a single agency or a single program. It's a way of governing that assumes surveillance is the default.
That assumption was born on September 12, 2001. The attacks created the political conditions for everything that followed, but the ideas and the capabilities were already there waiting for their moment. The tragedy was the catalyst, not the cause.
The cause was a set of ideas about executive power, about surveillance, about American military dominance, ideas that had been developed over decades and were ready to be implemented the moment the window opened. 9/11 opened the window.
The question Daniel's left us with, I think, is whether that window ever closes, or whether the security state is now a permanent feature of American life, self-justifying and self-perpetuating, with no off switch.
25 years in, the evidence suggests it's permanent. The controversies flare up, the reforms get debated, and the core capabilities remain. The database keeps growing, the watch lists keep expanding, the fusion centers keep fusing. Nobody's job is to make any of it smaller.
The public has largely made its peace with it. That's maybe the saddest part. The outrage that flared up after Snowden, after the Iraq WMD failure, after the torture report, it dissipated. The security state is now just part of the landscape, like the TSA checkpoint. You don't think about whether it should exist. You just take your shoes off and keep moving.
Thanks to Hilbert Flemingtop for producing, and for reminding us that the database is the thing that actually matters.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Find every episode at myweirdprompts.com or email the show at show@myweirdprompts.com.
We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show. My weird prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore. A thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.